I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump addressed a joint session of Congress last night calling for repealing the Affordable Care Act, rebuilding infrastructure, reforming the tax code, getting tough on immigration, and investing more money in defense. The most emotional moment was when he acknowledged the widow of Navy SEAL William Ryan Owens, who was killed during a commando raid in Yemen. Owens' father has refused to meet with the president when his son's body was flown to the U.S. and has called for an investigation into his death. President Trump did not call the press the enemy last night, as he has at other gatherings. There also wasn't a lot of detail, but there was a lot of applause coming from the Republicans. We asked Ron Elving to join us, NPR senior editor and correspondent. And Ron, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
Is this a kinder, gentler president that we saw last night?
It was a kinder, gentler president at times. And we did see, perhaps for the first time, that Donald Trump really can act presidential. We had waited for this, I think, all through the campaign. We had wondered when the moment might come when he would pivot, as we used to say, and stop acting like the Donald Trump candidate at a rally, or Donald Trump in a reality show, and actually play the part of president. And last night, he got that message. He read the speech that was given to him by his committee, if you will, his consortium of speechwriters, including his daughter Ivanka. And it was quite a different message at times. But, you know, it was also leavened, if you will, or balanced out, or spiked, perhaps would be a better word, by some of the Donald Trump that we saw in the inauguration speech and that we've seen so far in his governing.
So should we ask, will the real Donald Trump please stand up?
Well, I think we're certainly going to see more of both Donalds in the weeks and months ahead. The clear model here, and I remember these times well, was 1981 and Ronald Reagan's coming to the presidency. There was a lot of question among in some quarters as to whether or not Ronald Reagan was properly prepared to be president. He had been an actor. He had been governor of California for 8 years, so people had seen him in a political role. But he had a kind of reputation as well, and he also was at that time the oldest president to take the oath of office. And there were a lot of questions swirling around him. And he came out with this, you know, memorable mix of sunny optimism and stern prescriptions on policy. He was considered quite a hardliner in his day. So there is some echo there, and I think some of that was deliberate on the part of the Trump team.
How much do you think President Trump wants to spend? I have not done the math, but he talks about more money for the military, spending money on infrastructure. Those are big ticket items. Ron, do we know, is this going to break the budget?
The budget really is a notional thing that is broken in a sense all the time, in the sense that they deficit spend, and this goes back through most all of our presidencies since World War II. The government spends more money than it takes in, and we put a certain amount of money on the national debt every year. So in that sense, there is no budget that goes unbroken. The last time we came near balance was around 2000, and we immediately had a tax cut and filed that up with a couple of very expensive wars in the Middle East, destroying that chance for a surplus. So generally speaking, the federal government breaks its own budget every year. But in terms of at least the guidelines that the Republicans had worked out with President Obama in recent years, yes, those don't seem to mean much to Donald Trump. He has done most of his business career making extraordinarily liberal use of debt with mixed results. And he does not seem to have the usual Republican aversion to borrowing money. That just doesn't seem to bother him. So, for example, the $54 billion he's talking about increasing the federal budget for defense, which would be roughly a 10% increase, is to restore the depletion from the wars of the last 15 years, but doesn't really do much more than that. So when he talks about rebuilding the Navy and reinventing many of our different defense systems, that would require a great deal more money than he has talked about thus far, but he does buy a certain amount of Republican peace by talking about taking the sequester caps off of defense.
But where does that leave the deficit hawks, especially those in the GOP?
I believe that the deficit hawks are going to have a tough couple of years. The Paul Ryans of the party, who really do believe in reducing the deficit to zero and paying down the national debt, are going to have a difficult time dealing with the plans that Donald Trump has. He wants to do a $1 trillion infrastructure project. He wants to leave untouched Social Security and Medicare and perhaps Medicaid as well. Now, those are the drivers of the national debt. Those are the programs that cost the most, by far. They are the budget for all intents and purposes. Everything else that people think of as being federal spending, whether it's the federal judiciary or the EPA or foreign aid, which is 1% of the budget, all of those other things basically fit inside the amount of money that would be about 10-12% of the overall total. The big drivers are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and defense, and paying down the national, well, we have to pay, not down, but we right. have to pay the interest right. on the national debt.
Earlier in the day yesterday, he did meet with some news directors where he indicated that at least he might propose some kind of legal status to undocumented immigrants. There was no evidence of that last night. Do you know what happened, Ron?
Well, one theory is that his conversation with the news anchors yesterday was a conversation among people sitting around talking about issues, but that it didn't have much to do with what Donald Trump was actually intending to say on Tuesday night, and not much to do with what he plans to do. Call it a head fake, if you will. People got very excited about it yesterday afternoon. There's a great deal of reporting of this, quote, drastic shift, unquote, as the White House described it. In the end, the president did not say anything about how he might compromise with respect to his views and Republican views on immigration, but he did use this as a potential bridge-building opportunity to Democrats, and theoretically at least, if he were willing to discuss a path to citizenship or some other form of dealing with the Dreamers, the people brought here by their parents who were illegal immigrants, then there might be some basis on which to talk to the Democrats. But we didn't hear any more of that species of overture last night.
He did talk about removing the quote-unquote bad ones, the criminals, the gang members, the drug dealers. How different is that from what President Obama did?
It does not appear to be terribly different, except that it seems to go further than what the president described last night. In other words, there was a focus on gang members, on people with criminal records, on people who were, by consensus of the Obama administration, and by the way, those deportations were reaching record levels in the last couple of years, and that was upsetting to a lot of people in the immigrant community. They had a clear focus on real criminals or people who really had criminal records or people who were members of gangs. And the rest of the immigrant community that was here without legal right to be here was not being focused on. The new enforcement is different, not so much in the policy level, but in the encouragement of the enforcement agents themselves to define liberally whom they should be going after. And that's could be a substantial difference. We don't know all the numbers yet, but there appears to be a new set of marching orders.
It was such an emotional moment when the widow of William Ryan Owens, that was the Navy SEAL who was killed in this commando raid in Yemen, and she, you know, the applause went on for what seemed like minutes, and she had just tears streaming down her face and looking up, I guess, to the heavens to where she believed her husband was. But curiously, Trump had blamed Owens' death on the generals. He had called this a highly successful raid. He approved the raid, and yet somehow seemed to be blaming other people.
Yes, this was one of the curious turns of the story yesterday, which took several different turns in the course of one day. And at one point in the conversation earlier in the day, the president seemed to be saying that it wasn't a really big deal. He shrugged his shoulders and approved the raid, but that the generals had really wanted to do it. And then, quote, they lost Ryan. I guess what he meant by that was just that Ryan was lost. There has been a great deal said about what this raid might have been intended to do. We don't really know. Some people believe that it was intended to get at a single person, a particular person who was not found or was not killed, and that all this collateral damage and so on is now being justified on the basis of some intelligence, some computers, some other material that might have been gathered in this raid, whether or not it would have been worth the life of one Navy SEAL, or certainly 30 approximately civilians who were apparently killed, lots of other fighters killed on the other side. Whether or not they would have done this, given the haul that they came back with and the apparent frustration of the overall mission, that's pretty dubious at this point. But there is going to be more emotion about this, and it's going to have a higher profile now because of that extraordinary moment that you described.
Absolutely. He certainly did talk about repealing the Affordable Care Act. He said this is going to be really hard, something that sounds like he just discovered that this might be really hard. But where does this put the Republicans? And we know, of course, the House, I think, tried more than 50 times to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. They couldn't do it when Obama was president. But where, Ron, does this leave this particular issue? And now we're finding that people actually like the Affordable Care Act when it's now on the chopping block.
Yes, and of course, we've known for years that if you call it the Affordable Care Act, it does much, much better in public opinion polls than if you call it Obamacare. That's the same sort of dynamic as finding out now that the number of Republicans who think the economy is in good shape has quadrupled just since November 8th. And that has a lot to do, of course, with how people perceive policy in terms of their own politics. Now, when people find out that they themselves are getting something from Obamacare, whether it's keeping their own children on their insurance policy until those children are 26, or whether it's the opportunity to get health care insurance even if you have a pre-existing condition, they don't want to be deprived of anything that they have right now. Now, there are a lot of people who have problems with Obamacare in the sense that they have problems with their health insurer and they got their health insurance through Obamacare. Without Obamacare, of course, they might not have any at all, or they might be paying yet higher premiums under the system that preceded Obamacare. But we are finding out now that people are getting a little bit more aware of this as the repeal impends, and we still don't know what the replacement might be. We keep being told that it's about ready to go, but the program that was circulated last week, or the plan, the proposal that was circulated last week, has been absolutely stop-signed by the conservative caucuses of the House Republicans. They don't want to do what was being proposed. They don't like Paul Ryan, their speaker's plan. So this is very much up in the air, and we really don't know what the shape of replacement is going to be, if there's going to be any replacement at all.
Ron, final question, about 45 seconds. The president has signed a lot of executive orders. He's gotten a lot of coverage, a lot of attention for that. Is that the same thing as legislation?
No. An executive order can be overturned either by legislation, if Congress should actually do something on the subject, or by the federal judiciary, as we saw the court in Seattle and then the court in San Francisco do with respect to the travel ban. And then we're going to go around on that one again. We expect to see the new version of that executive order tomorrow or by Friday, more likely Friday.
So buckle our seatbelts.
Buckle your seatbelts, Marty.
Ron, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times. Always appreciate talking with you.
Thank you.
And that is Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent. And we were talking about last night's address by the president to a joint session of Congress. We're going to take a very short break and then shift gears entirely. We're going to go back 800 years and talk about the 13th century Persian poet Rumi. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. I've had some hankering for some poetry recently, a good antidote to the stresses of our modern world. And thankfully, we have a 13th century poet to provide some guidance and inspiration, Rumi. His poetry is popular today. You can find his words on greeting cards, in wedding vows, on shower curtains. But who was this man who spoke so passionately and so provocatively about love and faith? Our guest, Brad Gooch, is the author of a new book about Rumi titled Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Gooch learned Persian to learn to be able to read and translate Rumi's poetry, and he traveled more than 2,500 miles to many of the places in the Middle East where Rumi lived and worked, both as a child and as an adult. Brad Gooch is a poet, he's a novelist, and a biographer, joins us here in our Philadelphia studio, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here with you, Marty.
You know, I think a lot of people feel like they know Rumi through his poetry, but I have to say, reading your book, I wonder how much people really know Rumi himself.
Well, I was the same way. I mean, I was attracted to Rumi by his poetry in the 1990s, and at a certain point then started asking myself, well, who is Rumi? And even when I was writing the book, I would ask people their ideas of Rumi, who maybe had at their wedding, a poem of Rumi had been read, and they said, well, I think he was Buddhist. And,
you know, really?
So there's, you know, very little depth often to at least to our understanding.
Do you think the fact that he is so popular today, and again, wedding vows, greeting cards, I was reading about shower curtains, does that in any way diminish his poetry?
I don't think so. I mean, Rumi's a very forgiving muse in a certain way, so there's a kind of inclusiveness about his work and this love poetry that speaks to people. At the same time, the further you go into him and the more of this poetry you read, it's very much grounded in his Muslim tradition. There's a lot of the Quran, which he had obviously memorized throughout the work. So there's also a kind of substance there.
You had to learn Persian in order to really understand Rumi.
I did. I don't know
how
if
how hard was that?
I don't know if I thought through. I know it was a labor of love, but the labor-intensive part, I don't know if I completely understood. But I did realize that I needed to study Farsi, which I did with a tutor, Maryam Mortaz, whose role then grew to being co-collaborator with me on translations in the book. But I did two immersion programs at University of Texas Austin, University of Wisconsin-Madison, where you live in a dorm and speak 24/7. Farsi with your fellow students who tend to be 19 years old.
That's an education, right?
That was the most demanding moment, yes.
And you did travel several thousand miles just to understand Rumi's world. And he moved a lot, both as a child and, I mean, he did settle down as an adult, but a rather itinerant life he had.
Yes, well, the map of Rumi's life extends 2,500 miles from Tajikistan, Central Asia, where he was born in 1207, to Konya in what's now Turkey, where he dies in 1273. And he was living in a very tumultuous time. He came from a family of preachers and teachers and jurists, and they left Central Asia at a certain point and then found that they couldn't return because of Genghis Khan and the Mongols, who destroyed his birth land, basically Khorasan, the old Eastern Persian Empire. Uh-huh. And this, I mean, that to me is the fact that comes through most clearly about one of America's favorite poets now, is that he was Muslim and that he spent a part of his life as a refugee and a displaced person and an immigrant.
You talk about the sound of camels. I mean, if you're itinerant at that time or moving, you're going to move in many ways by camel, but also how the sound, the rhythm of camels mm-hmm. perhaps influences poetry.
Right. Well, the meter in Arabic poetry, they always claim are these different camel patterns and things.
Oh, is that right?
Which is probably apocryphal. But but still, he would have heard all this music that was sung by the drivers of the camels and the mules. And also, he's moving through different cultures, Arabic-speaking cultures. He was Persian-speaking. And at that time, interestingly, in my research, you realize that all these cities that he went through, Baghdad, Samarkand, Damascus, Aleppo, they were all combinations of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim populations. So they're very much in each other's face in a way that happens less now, I think.
Your book begins in Aleppo, of all places, in Syria. It's 2011, and you bump into this guy named Sebastian on the street. And he tells you about Rumi.
Yes, in the old marketplace, I was trying to make a little map, and this turned out to have been the Friday that the civil war erupted in Syria. I was making this drawing. This guy is driving by on a bike and stops and says, "Are you a spy?" I feel a little startled by this. All and right. He laughs. I realize it's a kind of a joke. And he said, "Well, what are you doing?" And I say, "Well, I'm writing a book about Rumi, who's a poet who's famous now in America." And he says, "Oh, no. He's one of my favorite poets in the world." And he starts reciting an English translation. He'd been at school in Britain. And then he leaves and he says, "Rumi's one of my favorite poets, like Shakespeare or your Walt Whitman. He never tells his secret." And this little bell went off in my head at that moment, which led to my title. And part of the theme
yes.
of the book.
Well, you don't want to give away too many secrets, no. but when the title of your book is Rumi's Secret, how should we think about, and in certain ways, to me, reading the book, it's Rumi's secrets, mm-hmm. but perhaps secret will work. How are we supposed to think about that word, what that means?
Well, interestingly, this was early on in my research, and the word ser, which is Persian for secret, is a big word for Rumi. And and finally you realize that you're right. It's always about love in some way, but in different dimensions, the personal, the poetic, and the religious, theological in some way. And that's at the center of his work. Interestingly, just footnote,
sure.
I've been looking for Sebastian. I talk about it in the afterword to the book because of what has happened in Aleppo. And finally, just 2 days ago, I get this email from Sebastian himself, who is living in England and has some silk rugs and his books with him and is trying to get his mother, who's 77 years old, out of Aleppo. So that kind of transformation tells what kind of world we're living in, but it was also the kind of world that Rumi was living in. I mean, there's a lot of tumult. It was a time of great political chaos and disorder, and somehow in the midst of it, Rumi and others around him, other Sufis, other Persian poets, were having this kind of brilliant moment of poetry and thought.
His father was a cleric, and he grew up in a family of privilege, had status, I guess, mm-hmm. money, wealth.
Yeah, well, they were a religious family and a family of preachers and teachers and jurists. Interestingly, though, probably no one called Rumi during his lifetime. It means from Rome, because when they wind up in Turkey, that was the old Roman Empire, the old Eastern Byzantine Empire. And it was an unusual place for Muslims to be. It was an 80% Christian, Armenian, Greek population. So his actual name was Mohammed, like many boys in his neighborhood. And when he was 6 years old, he told his father that he was seeing angels. And his father sort of encouraged this by giving him some nicknames like Coat of Angar, Jalaluddin, the Glory of the Faith. So he was encouraged in that way in the religious path. But certainly by the time he becomes an adult, he's a more radical figure than his father and grandfather had been.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Brad Gooch, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Our guest is a poet as well. And you can join our conversation calling our comment line, or you can text us at our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation talking about the poet Rumi. Well, let's jump ahead, and he meets this man, the Shams of Tabriz.
Right.
Who is this man?
It was very interesting. Rumi now, at age 37, has followed in the footsteps of his father in kind of traditional way. He has a wife. He has three children. He has teaching posts at four colleges. He's a charismatic, somewhat famous preacher. And he meets Shams of Tabriz, an itinerant mystic who's about 90 or 60. Sorry, years older than him. And they have an electric connection between them, enough so that Rumi and Shams go off into seclusion for 3 months and then come back, and then for another 6 months are in seclusion, which causes great consternation and dissonance in the family and in his community. But during this time, Shams is really encouraging Rumi to shift from a path of knowledge to a path of the heart and the path of love, and away from writing of sermons and fatwas towards poetry, music, and song. And in some way, he recognizes Rumi as the creative poet that he is. And all the poems that we have of Rumi come after this meeting with Shams of Tabriz. So he has this great effect on him.
The obvious question is, were they lovers? And I have to say, I'll have you read some of the poems of Rumi's poetry in here. There's great passion
right.
that he has for this man.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely love between these two men. And their separation eventually, Shams of Tabriz disappears, is the pain out of which Rumi writes some of his greatest poems. I mean, there's no evidence that there was an erotic relationship between the two of them, but there's, you know, absolutely a felt love. And part of Rumi's theme in his poetry is, or an issue is, where human love and divine love cross. And what does it mean that the love for Shams is what opens him to the love of God, and that they reflect each other? I mean, all that is the world that he explores in his poetry.
I'd love to have you read one of Rumi's poems about fasting. And he seemed, as you write, sort of an ecstatic about fasting.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying that that he definitely came out of this Muslim tradition and remained within it. I mean, he prayed five times a day throughout his life. He fasted for Ramadan, but he really took fasting to the extreme. He had a great love for fasting, almost the altered state of it. I'll just read one of his Ramadan poems. Congratulations, the month of fasting is here. Have a good journey, my companion in fasting. I climbed to the roof to see the moon. With my heart and soul, I longed for fasting. When I looked up, my hat fell off. My head was set spinning by the king of fasting.
It's beautiful, and right. I love my hat fell off. I mean, just that little aside within
that
poem.
Well, he is this great poet. I mean, he has this modern appeal, and partly because of his images.
He also, there's this whirling part. Was it Shams? Did he introduce him to whirling?
Yeah, I mean, supposedly there's a story that Rumi's grandmother back in Khorasan had taught him some whirling, but he was a little boy and it just meant waving his arms in the air. But Shams of Tabriz encouraged him in this whirling as a spiritual practice and kind of meditation. Rumi eventually writes poems while he's whirling. And after his death, basically, growing up around him was the Mevlevi order of whirling dervishes that we know today. Then it becomes almost codified as a religious practice and a religious dance, a little like what happened with St. Francis of Assisi, I think, who was a kind of charismatic, hard-to-place figure and poet while he was alive. And then after his death, we got the Franciscan order congealing.
Have you ever whirled? Have you tried it?
I have tried.
What is that like?
Well, it's great. And
is it great?
But you can. I mean, there's a trick to it, which is you focus on your thumb, which keeps you from getting dizzy. And and the great part then finally becomes you don't know how long this has been going on, and there's a kind of rhythmic pattern to it. That I think after Shams of Tabriz mysteriously disappeared, Rumi really uses whirling almost to keep his sanity in a way, this kind of regular, repetitive kind of drumming beat that goes along with whirling.
What do we know about Shams' disappearance? Am I correct that he married Rumi's young stepdaughter? Did I get that right?
Well, there was a young woman in the household who may or may not have been the stepdaughter of Rumi. And, I mean, this seems to be in part to create some stability, it seems, and to become part of Rumi's household. Then Kimiya dies that winter.
Kimiya's
the young woman Shams married. And this, adds to the dark cloud that's already over Shams of Tabriz. So as much as Rumi and Shams had this great connection and infatuation, not many other people really approved of Shams of Tabriz and these changes that were happening in their beloved teacher while he was around. Mm-hmm. Also, this is what I like about biography. I mean, if I was writing a novel or if I was in central casting for a movie, I would not come up with Shams of Tabriz as a spiritual teacher. I mean, he was a very irascible kind of misanthropic character who didn't suffer fools gladly, who was very interested in Rumi and in nobody else. So it didn't translate
something
well.
Something a little not evil, but sort of scary.
Yes, edgy about Shams of Tabriz. And so when he would walk down the streets, eventually there were stories of people would flash knives at him or mutter things under their breath. All this leads to, in part, I think, his disappearance. There were even rumors that one of Rumi's sons, Alauddin, had murdered Shams of Tabriz because he was upset at what was happening to the family brand, in a way, the legacy. Again, probably didn't happen, but there was definitely a lot of tumult and even an edge of violence and upset around the relationship of Rumi and Shams of Tabriz, partly because they didn't fit into a pattern. I mean, they were in a traditional society where there were a sheikh, a spiritual teacher, would have a young disciple. These relationships could be erotic sometimes, as in on the old Greek Socrates-Plato model. That was fine. But between Rumi and Shams of Tabriz, even Shams complains at one point, I need to know what we are. Are we teacher and student? Mm-hmm. Are we friend and companion? Rumi reports someone saying, I can't tell who is the lover and who is the beloved. So in this sort of traditional setup, because they were so equal, I think, that this created a certain amount of anxiety.
And jealousy, I guess. I mean, people on the outside or perhaps Rumi's children.
Yes, exactly.
Family.
Right. Yeah, so definitely jealousy and uncertainty around this. So one reason I think I was drawn to the story of Rumi when I first heard more about it, and I was writing a book called God Talk in around 1999, and there was a chapter on Muslims in New York City. And I took part in a Sufi group that would meet on Friday nights on the Upper West Side in the apartment of Imam Faisal Raouf. And in that group, I mean, Faisal, first of all, was stressing the religious writings of Rumi that had been written down by students more than the poetry we were all hearing. And also from other members of the group who are mainly young Muslim Americans in their 20s and 30s, I heard the story of Rumi's life. And just the writer in me thought, this is an amazing story because of this midlife transformation.
We'll pick up on that after this very short break. Brad Gooch is our guest on Radio Times today, and his book is called Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us or texting our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are not talking about Donald Trump. We are talking about the 13th century Persian poet Rumi. And our guest is poet and author Brad Gooch. And his book is called Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. I want to have you read a section where he talks about wives. We should talk about Rumi and women. But let's start with that first reading. And then he has another little, as you say, more sympathetic view of women.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you get two attitudes towards Rumi, one more conventional for his time towards women and another looking a little further, which often happens with him. And as for the first,
right.
He talks about wives as being a kind of purifying test for their husbands. He said, this was written down by students, God showed the prophet a narrow and hidden way to refine himself, and that was the path of marrying women and enduring their tyranny and listening to their complaints and letting them order him around. Character would only become pure through such patient forbearance. So there you get pure medieval
yes, you
Rumi.
Do.
But somewhere else, he said, in the Masnavi, he wrote about women, a woman is a ray of God, heavenly and beloved. She is a creator uncreated from above. And he actually had pretty forward relationships with women. When he was a sheikh later and we were talking about doing the whirling, he would meet with these wives who were disciples of his and women. Their husbands would have to stand outside sort of on guard because this wasn't really allowed. Women were taking off their veils and this was at night, whirling and meditating. So he had different sorts of relationships with women.
Was he viewed in any way or at any time as a heretic to his religion?
Well, within Islam at that time, as now, there was a tension between sort of fundamentalist traditional view of Islam and the Sufi view. So the Sufi is a mystical branch or interpretation of Islam that stressed more the intimacy with God, the closeness of the human and divine, and encourage then poetry, music, and song within religion. And the fundamentalists were especially opposed to music. So Sufis had been executed historically. Halaj, who Rumi loved, was executed for saying, "I am the truth."
That's right.
Another famous Sufi said, "Glory be to me." So these were kinds of statements that could get you in trouble. Rumi skirted trouble. There was a fatwa brought against him once for using a rabab musical instrument in his practice, as there was against Shams of Tabriz for supposedly drinking wine. So they were, this tension existed. Rumi was protected almost.
By whom?
Well, they wound up in Konya, which was being ruled by the Seljuk Turks at that point. So these Seljuks were Muslim from Central Asia, but they were, a bit outside, a bit of an outpost. They brought in Persians like Rumi's father and poets who had been displaced to teach both religion and art to people and sort of grow a culture. So a lot of these people were disciples of Rumi. The Queen Mother was a disciple of Rumi. Hmm. So he had that kind of protection. And he had some
friends
kind of
in high places.
Friends
perhaps.
In high places. So writing the biography, I traced the political Rumi, which is interesting. I mean, he was definitely able to be clever about guarding himself and his community. But he also had charm, and he was also writing these poems, which were probably as moving then as they are now, which gave him some leeway.
I'd love to have you read another poem, but we should talk first about his relationship with, he was a goldsmith, right? Salahuddin. Salahuddin.
Yeah. After Shams of Tabriz disappears, Rumi has two other beloveds. First, Salahuddin, who is an illiterate goldsmith, who he puts in charge of his community and has deliver his sermons for him and teach his classes, which is kind of an audacious slap at the system, I think. And the
to
other,
have an illiterate person,
right?
That's
right. So he was always teaching these kind of funny lessons, I think. And after that, Hosamuddin, who was 20 years younger than him, who wrote down his entire 6-volume epic in couplets, so it was almost a collaboration between them. But he always made a distinction. Shams of Tabriz was the sun, Salahuddin was the moon, and Hosamuddin was starlight or rays of sun. So in his personal cosmology, he had that. But he did write, beautiful poems to Salahuddin, not as many, but as he had to Shams of Tabriz. I can read one.
This is a beautiful one. Yeah, please.
At the end of time, no one will help you. Only Salahuddin, only Salahuddin. If you've learned the secret of his secret, don't breathe a word, let no one know. A lover's chest is a fresh, flowing stream. Souls float on its waters like sticks and straw. When you see his face, don't breathe a word. Breathing will only fog the mirror. A sun rises from within the lover's heart, filling the entire world with light.
Beautiful. I mean, precise, concise, the imagery.
Right. But you see this imagery of mirrors and reflected light. I mean, that's the way, when you're asking me about what was the nature of Rumi's relationship with Shams of Tabriz, I remember Ron Chernow said when you're writing about the founding fathers, don't bring in Freud because it throws you out of that world.
Always dangerous, so, right?
So I tried to stay within their understanding of what this love was. And it was always about that the beloved is a mirror and the lover sees himself in his friend and God is the light that reflects in the mirror. And, that was the way they were looking at the world. It's very beautiful.
It's interesting to read these poems now and try to imagine in the 13th century how they might be read by someone who's a Sufi or a questioning person. Were these poems popular in his day?
Well, they were popular with his circle. I mean, they were popular in Konya, and he really wrote them to teach his students and disciples. His Masnavi spiritual epic that he wrote at one point. Hosamuddin comes to him and says, all of your students aren't reading their Sufi manuals. They're reading these poems by Attar, like Conference of the Birds. Why don't you, Rumi, write your own teaching poem? And then at that moment, Rumi supposedly took out from his hat The first 16 lines that he had already written, having had the same idea, which was the opening of the Masnavi, one of the more famous poems in world literature.
Do you remember the opening? Can you
I remember it? Beshno as nechen chekayat mikonad, gaz noi mekanat mikonad, az jodai. Anyway, I would need it in front of me, but it's listen to the reed flute and the tale that it tells, how it sings of separation.
Uh-huh.
So it's this great poem of separation. The Persian word jodai, separation, was the name of the movie that won the Academy Award 2 years ago, and so it's always a theme and connected with love in that culture. And for Rumi, becomes, especially as he matures, simultaneously separation of lover and beloved, but also everyone from God.
You mentioned that this was a part of the world where Christians and Jews and Muslims lived in close proximity.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to preach tolerance. I mean, his view of other religions, and it's interesting to think about that today when it feels as if there is so much conflict and mistrust between religions.
Mm-hmm. No, well, he's become a sort of interfaith icon, and rightfully so. I mean, especially later in life, he develops this notion of the religion of love, and that the only religion for lovers is God. Since we worship the one God, all religions must be one. And so it always seems to be, you know, pushing beyond these differences of religion and also of race. He says, if he is Turk or Tajik, I'm close to him. For this moment, I mean, especially a counter narrative of the, affinity and similarity between people, between cultures, between religions. He sees the, you know, the source of all religions in the kind of mysticism, really. When you discover the source of sunlight, whatever direction you go will be east. So that's that is very inclusive view of religion. And we know that it was edgy at that time, I think, because his funeral included not just singers and dancers and poets reading his poems, but Christian priests reciting the gospel and Jewish rabbis reciting the psalms. The funeral was actually stopped at a certain point by his followers, who feel it's being taken away from them. It's adjudicated by the parvane, the governor, and the Christian priest says, well, you don't realize how much time he spent with us in the Armenian neighborhoods, at the monastery of Plato. You don't know what you had there. So there was a way in which he had gone beyond the usual in reaching beyond denominations.
Does that explain, you think, his popularity today? The fact that so many people read Rumi?
I do think so. I mean, I think two things. I think that this message of inclusiveness and also the way that when he's writing about love, he's writing simultaneously about human love and spiritual love. And it gives a kind of romance to the spiritual search that I think is also gripping.
The idea that the love of God is a kind of romantic quest or expression.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So Valentine's Day is a religious holiday. That's part of Rumi's secret. And the other way, the secret of his success, appeal at the moment, I think.
I'd love to have you read another poem. You talk about Rumi's death. First of all, do we know how old he was when he died?
He was 67.
Okay. So he lived, I guess, a long life for a 13th century person.
Long enough. I think his father supposedly lived longer. But in terms of life expectancy, yes, I mean around 60, then you would achieve the age of wisdom and were preparing for death in some way. So he lived a full life. He also, I mean, he wasn't easy on himself with all the fasting and not sleeping and writing poetry.
Well, I'd love to have you read, this is on page 282 for those of our listeners who are following along.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, he was almost death radiant towards the end in some of this writing. Squeezed in the womb like a baby, I'm eager to move on after 9 months. If my mother were feeling no labor pains, I might be left in this burning jail. But the pains of death are telling her, the time has come for the Lamb to be born, so that he may graze in lush green fields, open wide the womb. The Lamb is ready.
It's so interesting to use the metaphor of a baby being born mm-hmm. with dying, with death.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, he saw, I mean, once he said, everyone has been born once, I've been born many times. So he was interested in children and in babies, and then he saw then the spiritual life as this constant change and being reborn and not being attached. I think the challenge for me writing the book was actually this last part, because Rumi was almost eager and joyous about death, longing for death. He said at one point, Shams of Tabriz is calling me from one side and my disciples are calling me from the other side. And that I found the hardest to almost wrap my head around.
Thinking about your own death?
Yes. And I mean, I'm used to spirituality being involved with the here and now in our material world. So longing for death has not particularly been part of it. But by working through this, I did come to appreciate Rumi's joy. I mean, finally, he turns everything into joy.
After he dies, does his sort of legacy live on?
Very much so. I mean, it could easily have disappeared because the Seljuk Empire is wiped out. That civilization disintegrates. And yet at first, Rumi's son and grandson really set up then this kind of Mevlevi order.
Yeah.
And then that begins to spread. And with the Mevlevi order spread Rumi's poems. And then somehow in the 18th century, someone in Germany, he starts appealing to Goethe in Germany, to Emerson in the United mm-hmm. States. And here we are today, listening to him.
Absolutely. Let me get a caller on the air. This is Dan from Lansdowne.
This is Dan from Lansdowne, and I'm wondering how widely translations of Rumi into English vary, and what were the particular problems the guest may have noticed in his own translations.
It's a good question.
That's
Dan.
A great
yeah.
question.
About
Thanks.
A minute or so before we for your answer there, Dan Brad Goot.
Right. There's a wide range of translation of Rumi, and it can go from these very Cambridge Don translations by Arbery Nicholson, for instance, and a kind of freer beat poetry by Coleman Barks, right. which was when we say Rumi's the best-selling poet in America, we're talking about those translations. A poet said to me, I think, that Rumi is translation-proof. And there is something about that I've found in all these translations, and some of them are beautiful and some of them are clunky, that there's this a kind of voice and imagery and certainly a vision that comes through that maybe can partly explain this. The other half is in terms of my translating. The language in some way is simple and it's written in a rhythmic sing-song way. The ideas, though, are always swerve. I mean, Rumi's always conflating this, for instance, human and divine love, and to do it, he goes in circles. Hmm. I think he would definitely agree with Emily Dickinson about the truth is tell the truth in circuit.
Tell the truth in circuit?
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrific.
Right.
Brad Goot, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio
yes,
Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, the book is Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Brad Goot, our guest, he is a poet himself, also a novelist, wrote a memoir, and he's a biographer as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. And we did take some photos before the show began. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.